Welcome to the China MENA podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan Fulton, a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlanta Council and a political scientist at Zayed University in Abu Dhabi, United Arab Emirates. On this episode, we're going to broaden the scope and add Russia to the mix. The U.S. Department of Defense has identified China and Russia as its two primary threats. And over the past few years, we've seen Beijing and Moscow working much more closely on a wide range of bilateral issues. They're also using multilateral institutions like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and BRICS in an effort to reshape global order. This has implications for the Middle East, where both China and Russia have emerged as important next regional powers. In October of this year, Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Mikhail Bogdanov said that the two countries are coordinating their Middle East policies, making for an even more complex regional landscape. To help us understand what Russia's up to in the Middle East and how China fits in, I've got two great guests, Mark Katz and Lee Chen Sim. Mark is a professor of government and politics at George Mason University and is also a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlanta Council. He writes mainly on Russian foreign and security policy, especially towards the Middle East. Lee Chen is a political scientist at Khalifa University in Abu Dhabi, United Arab Emirates. She's also a non-resident scholar at the Middle East Institute. She's a specialist in the political economy of Russian and China, Russian and Gulf energy, and its intersection with international relations. Mark, Lee Chen, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, wanted to have you two on for a long time. As you know, Russia in the Middle East is always an evergreen topic, and when you throw China in, it's everybody wants to talk about it. So, Mark, we'll start with you. Just broadly speaking, what are Russia's interests in the Middle East, and what tools does it use to achieve them?
Well, Russia has several interests, I think, in the Middle East. One is that it's an arena in which it can compete with the United States in its ongoing competition, and it's one in which it has, I think, several advantages. Some of those advantages, I think, come about because of American foreign policy missteps. One of their interests is to prevent jihadism spilling over from the Middle East into the Muslim regions of the Russian Federation and, of course, elsewhere in the former Soviet Union. Of course, there are indigenous sources of jihadism within these Muslim regions, and the Russians have been pretty good at suppressing them. But they want to make sure that the Russia's Muslim regions don't become like Afghanistan was in the 1980s, a cause celebre for the whole Muslim world. And then I think another interest is simply to advance Russia's economic interests, and certainly with regard to its oil production and cooperation with Saudi Arabia in particular in the OPEC Plus format. The Russians also sell a considerable amount of weaponry to the Middle East, and also they're interested in selling nuclear reactors. So there's petroleum, weapons, atomic reactors. These are the three main exports, plus, of course, grain as well, and the Middle East is a big buyer of grain. And some of the tools that they use, the main tool is that their interests coincide with those of many of the authoritarian governments in the Middle East, which are also, nervous about Western, especially American, push for democratization and human rights in the past. People who are human rights experts would say that America hasn't pushed very hard, but from the point of view of both the Russian government and many Middle Eastern governments, it's pushed way too hard. And also, I think these governments are also opposed to jihadism, and so I think that that in terms of as well as arms sales, as well as cooperation on oil, cooperation diplomatically over a number of issues, that Russia has a lot of levers to pursue its interests in the region.
Oh, that's great. That's a really great overview. Lee Chen, last year you and I published a report for the Atlanta Council looking at China and Russia in the Middle East. Do you see their interests in the region converging, diverging, or somewhere in between? Are there specific countries or sectors where they support each other or where they're more competitive with each other?
Well, I think that's a great question. In terms of convergence, you know, you noted the statement that, you know, we are going to coordinate and cooperate more closely on Middle East issues. And that is something that they have indicated repeatedly. You know, they signed joint statements, Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping, saying that they want peace and stability in the Middle East. So there's a lot of these noises about convergence. And indeed, we do see some examples of convergence. For example, they both support alternative trade routes to Europe that go through the Middle East, for example. Of course, the reason for that is that these trade routes are seen to be possible sanctions proof, or at least they can bust some of the sanctions that the US are putting on Russia and that they could possibly put on China as well. So they do converge on these alternative trade routes to Europe. Where I see that they converge as well is diplomatically around the world. For example, you have widening the membership of the Shanghai Cooperation to some of the Middle Eastern countries. And this would be, you know, in a kind of potential competition, let's say, to the OSCE, European-US-led order. Another example is in the banks. So they've set up the New Development Bank under the BRICS, as well as the Asian Infrastructure Bank. You have some Middle East members in there. Those are led by China and Russia. And again, you know, that is a counterpart to, say, the more US and European-led IMF, as well as the World Bank and EBRD. Where they converge as well is also probably in moving away from using the dollar in trades between the Middle East and China and Russia, so that there are some examples of Middle Eastern countries using the yuan to settle some of their trades. So I think this is where they converge in trying to de-dollarize or at least move more payments out of the dollar into another currency, in this case the yuan, again thinking of like sanctions busting methodology. But I think they don't always converge, and whether they diverge or whether they are somewhere in between, I think a good example is the Hamas-Israel war, where they seem to converge because they both vetoed a US draft resolution that emphasized Israel's right to self-defense. Obviously, they have both pushed for a ceasefire declaration because they both know that the US will oppose this. So they do converge in this kind of a diplomatic push to make, you know, the US look pretty bad in the Middle East and around the world. But I think generally they are somewhere in between in terms in the Middle East in some areas. For example, China is more a status quo power with regards to the US presence in the Middle East, whereas, and it's not quite so happy sometimes with some of the Russian actions, which tend to destabilize the Middle East. After all, China is an oil importer. It's got important trade and investments here. But so do they diverge here? I think it's worth watching, particularly since China has introduced its global security initiative last year that takes into account more security-based threats or interests or responses to the Middle East and worldwide. So I think it is more interested now in peace and in using security measures to try to calm some of the conflicts instead of just using development measures. So this could, you know, be also another form of convergence with the Russian approach of a more security-led approach. But time will tell, Jonathan.
Yeah, there's a lot of good stuff in there. I just want to follow up, like I mentioned when I asked you the question, we wrote this report last year, and we'll put a link to it on the show page. But one of the concepts that we wrote about was Russia and China's force multipliers in the Middle East. And I think it's interesting because what you're bringing up, you know, is that, you know, China is more leaning a little more to the status quo because of its economic interests, because of its large expatriate population, because of its energy needs. Russia, you know, has proven to be less willing to pursue the status quo in the region. You know, its support for Syria and working with Iran puts it at odds sometimes with the more status quo oriented countries. What is it about these two countries working together that results in this force multiplier dynamic?
Well, so force multiplier, let me just define what you and I meant in this report. Force multiplier is whereby they can reinforce, not just reinforce, but strengthen each other's interests and narratives in the Middle East and make them together seem more powerful or influential than they are individually, right? So they are multiplying their effect in the Middle East on both the Middle Eastern actors as well as, say, on US perception of their influence in the Middle East. So an example of it would be in the media. So in the media, sometimes we see that Russia and China echo each other's statements or even cartoons or even Twitter or social media posts, both in the English language version of Russian sites in the Middle East, like RT and Sputnik. And China does the same thing with its English language or Arabic language, sites in the Middle East. They sometimes echo the Russian positions or take material from the Russian media. So it kind of, again, reinforces or gives the image, that it's not just from China, but it's from Russia as well. This is how, this is what the world looks like. This is what you're doing. It's not just China saying this, but Russia is saying this. So it just adds to that volume of noise about what China, Russia, and the US are doing in the Middle East, particularly, trying to say that the US is not to be trusted, the US doesn't stick with its friends, etc. So this just amplifies the volume about views about the US. But it's not just about the media. I think in terms of security, they've had also like joint military drills with Iran. This was back in March 2023 in the Gulf of Oman. So this again adds to the impression that, it's not just China who is more militarily active in the Middle East, Russia is as well. We see that in terms of drone sales, whereby you have the Chinese selling Taihong drones to Saudi Arabia, you have them selling Wingloan drones to the UAE. And I think this kind of complements the more like the anti-ballistic missiles that Russia sells or has sold, is selling to Iran, Turkey, and Syria, their S-300s and S-400s. So it's kind of like a teamwork effort, right? You sell this and the Chinese say, we will sell that. And that kind of amplifies against the idea that the US is losing ground in terms of its weapon sales here, and the Chinese and the Russians are gaining ground. So it's this kind of force multiplier effect. And I think that's what we meant in the report. Also, I can give an example of, say, diplomatically, they both had numerous bilateral and multilateral visits, as you've mentioned in your introduction. Most recently, for example, UAE was the guest of honor in mid-23 in the St. Petersburg Economic Forum. China held the GCC China Forum in 2023. So again, this gives the impression that the region is somehow tilting away diplomatically from the US towards other actors, in this case, towards China and Russia, which are the pacing and long-term competitors to the US, as you mentioned.
Yeah, that's interesting. I was doing a project throughout the region in late 22 and early 23, and I traveled around the Middle East quite a bit. And one of the recurring messages that we kept hearing was that, Russia's the muscle and China's the money. And I think most people in the countries we visited had pretty realistic assessments of both countries' power and influence in the region, but that they saw these two having these complementary factors that they brought to the table. They recognized the limitations of what they could do, but when they saw them as this, money and power coming in together, they thought it was pretty impressive. Mark, you've done a lot of great stuff on Russia and Iran. So, of course, I want to talk about this trilateral. Li Chen mentioned the naval drills. There were other ones in 2019. It gets a lot of people's attention, this idea of a so-called triple axis of Russia and China and Iran. Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, had said that the three would be a problem for the U.S. for years to come. Do you see this as an alignment that has the potential to alter the strategic landscape in the Middle East? Are there important areas of cooperation, or is this an axis of convenience?
I think it's more an axis of convenience, and I think that the more that the perception arises that U.S. Power and influence is declining, I think we'll see more divergence among the Axis partners. And I think already there is some reason for Russia to be jealous of China, because after all, when Iran and Saudi Arabia were looking for a mediator in terms of restoring diplomatic relations, whom do they turn to? They turn to China, not Russia. And recently, I think we've seen that I think Saudi leader, and I think Iranian leader or diplomats went to China with regard to the Hamas Israel conflict, not so much Russia. In other words, that they seem there seems to be a sense in the Middle East that China is the alternative to the U.S. in terms of conflict resolution and not Russia. And Russia has long advertised itself as the preferred alternative to the United States as a conflict resolution partner. So I think that we do see some beginnings. Also, Li Chen mentioned the complementary weapon sales, but one of the things we need to mention is, of course, the impact of the war in Ukraine, and this has limited Russia's ability to export weapons to some extent. In fact, we've seen that the Russians have actually bought back weapon systems, both from Myanmar and from India. Now, obviously, there was a recent sale to Iran, Su-35s in particular. These were supposed to have gone to Egypt. Under U.S. pressure, the Egyptians canceled out, and so they finally went to Iran, but it took quite a long time. And I think that the Russians are in a position where they need all the weapons that they can produce for themselves, and can they produce them as successfully as before because of the sanctions? So I think that the longer this war goes on, that in fact, China's influence may increase, not because of anything that China is necessarily doing, but because governments see China as a more reliable supplier in many respects than Russia. And of course, there's also the little matter that China is a petroleum importer. Russia, as a petroleum exporter, is competing, with these Gulf states. And even though we have cooperation in the OPEC Plus format, essentially, Russian oil sold at a discount. This is eating into what the Gulf producers could earn that they have to take this into account, that people who can will buy this cheaper oil, obviously. So I think that that in many respects, that while many in the Gulf in particular may not see the U.S. as strong a partner as they may have hoped, I think that what this war has pointed out is that maybe Russia isn't as reliable either. In other words, there's only so much Russia can do, and hence we see the attempt to draw China in. And I think that's also, I think, one of the important things is part of the reason why external great powers are influential in this part of the world is because there's a demand in this part of the world for great power patronage. And so I think that that there is a demand for greater Chinese activity, maybe more than the Chinese are interested in at the moment. But I think there's a sense that there's only so much that Russia can do at this point because of this war.
Yeah, I think the conflict in Gaza also changes that dynamic a bit too, because I think the limits of what China can offer has been made quite clear to a lot of countries in the region, where it doesn't really have the power to convene or to shape events on the ground. It's not really the power on this that people were hoping for. And I think a lot of countries or leaders in the region look at the U.S. response and how the U.S. has backed up Israel. And they might not like it, but I think they like the idea of it, to think like if we could get that kind of relationship with the U.S., if we could get those kind of security commitments, kind of like how people looked at Russia and Syria, That was something I heard a lot in the Gulf, right? Saying, I don't like what he's doing, but I love how he does it. And I think the same seems to be apparent right now. I think the limits, like you said, the limits of what Russia can offer to a lot of countries in the region has been exposed. And I think the limits of what China's willing to do has also been pretty exposed. I kind of agree with you on the access to convenience idea. Like, I think there's a narrative affinity that Russia, Iran, and China all agree that they don't like liberal international values and norms, and they'd like to see this changed. But beyond that, I don't really know that there's a lot of, coordination to try to offer some alternative. I think they're kind of like a negative power at this point, just saying what they don't like rather than offering something different.
Right. And I think for the Iranians, I mean, the frustrating thing about both Russia and China is that both Russia and China insist on having good relations with Iran's adversaries in the region, including the Gulf Arabs, but also including Israel. In other words, that despite whatever criticism that Russia and China have made, it seems that, cooperation continues. That Russia and China are not doing anything actively to harm what Israel is trying to achieve in the Gaza.
Yeah, and then just going back to what you're saying about the discounted oil, I think the same dynamic for Iran, where China, like you said, Li Chen has been using a lot of tools to buy, using teapot refineries that aren't connected to SWIFT, so they can buy a lot of discounted Iranian oil, often using bartering systems to do this. It's great for China. I don't know if it's that great for Iran, where they end up getting often, sub-quality products in return for this stuff. It kind of builds in a lot of the resentments and kind of feeds that vulnerability. But I wanted to go to the energy side. I'm glad you brought it up, Mark, because Li Chen is somebody, usually people ask me questions about energy and I can't answer beyond, a couple of minutes. And they ask questions about Russia and it's the same thing. So it was great when Li Chen and I worked in the same department. I could just, shout down the hall, hey, Li Chen, can you explain this thing about energy to me? So I'm going to do that now. On the energy side of things, like Mark alluded to, there's a buyer-seller dynamic when we think of Russian and Chinese engagement in the region. Obviously, China's, the biggest importer of crude. It's becoming a huge market for LNG. Russia, of course, is a competitor with a lot of Gulf and Middle East suppliers. So does this create opportunities for cooperation in the bilateral between Russia and China in this region, or is it a possible point of friction?
Well, I think for now there's more opportunities for cooperation, especially in oil, because as Mark mentioned, yes, Russia is selling more discounted oil to China, which China is happy to, lap up. But at the same time, China is not really reducing the amount of oil it purchases from, say, the Saudis, right? It is decreasing the amount it purchases from other suppliers, maybe, for example, in West Africa, but not really from the Saudis. In fact, the latest data shows that both its volumes from Russia and the Saudis are increasing, but obviously it's increasing much more in the case of Russia. Now, the question is, how can China, with its economy slowing down, be buying so much oil from both these countries? And the answer is storage, right? So China has a lot of storage, the strategic petroleum reserves. It has a lot, it is building more. And so quite a lot of the oil, crude oil, is going to these tanks. So, it may not necessarily be consuming everything that it buys, but part of it is going to the tanks, for a rainy day, for conflicts or whatever, so it can draw upon these reserves. So in that sense, China is quite, happy that Russia is not always fulfilling its quotas in OPEC, right? I mean, it's supposed to be cutting its quotas, but the data shows that it's not cutting by as much as it should, technically, according to the quotas. So I think China is quite happy in that sense that it is, kind of lukewarm about upholding the quotas. That's good news for China because it means that there is more oil than OPEC would expect on the market, and hence that decreases prices. So I think that's cooperation, or at least it's a kind of a fringe benefit for China in that sense in the Middle East in the form of OPEC Plus with all its other Middle Eastern friends. But in terms of LNG though, does China want to, is that an opportunity for China to import more Russian gas, more Russian LNG, now that Russia does not want to send the same amount of gas through the pipeline and there are moves by Europe to actually sanction or actually block imports of Russian LNG. Is that an opportunity for China? Well, it's not really an opportunity because there are no direct pipelines that can take away the gas meant for Europe to come to Asia. There is no pipeline that can go to the same fields which are supplying Europe with the Russian gas. So they actually have to build a new pipeline that can do that directly to China. And at the moment, they are negotiating on this pipeline that can redirect some of the European bound gas to China. But at the moment, China is holding out because it knows the longer it holds out, the better deal it could get because Russia could get more desperate, right? I mean, no one ever said it was easy negotiating with the Chinese. It wasn't difficult. It was very difficult with the power of Siberia 1, the first Russia-China pipeline. It's going to be even more difficult now that Russia has no other options. It's financially constrained, etc. And believe you me, I'm Chinese myself. I mean, Chinese ethnicity. I know what a hard bargain the Chinese can drive. So that's going to be difficult. But I think in terms of other areas of energy, there could be some competition in terms of, say, nuclear reactor exports. Russia already has a big market on that. And, Mark, you mentioned that. They have lots of projects going on in the Middle East and, of course, in other parts of the world. China doesn't have any Middle East projects at the moment. It does have some experience of exporting its reactors overseas, not a lot, not as much as Russia. But I think where the competition will come in will be when China actually commercializes its small modular reactors, something that Russia hasn't had much opportunity to do because it's been focused on its, you know, traditional huge reactors. Now, of course, going to be financially constrained, etc. It's going to be constrained in terms of technology because some parts of the process were imported from, you know, foreign suppliers. So I think this is where, in terms of SMR, the smaller nuclear reactors, if China's pouring a lot of money into that, and I think that could interest quite a lot of Middle Eastern countries, you know, who could want smaller reactors that are cheaper, that are faster to build, etc.
Yeah, you saw my question coming because that's something that China's been focusing on, trying to promote itself as a provider of nuclear energy in the region. And I was going to ask you if you thought that they had much of an advantage in trying to do this. You know, obviously, a lot of folks were looking to the Saudis not too long ago, as they've been saying they want a commercial nuclear reactor, and that there was a thought that China might step in. What do you think? Do you think China's got a shot at this?
Well, I think they've already put in a bid for it, right? So I think the French have a bid, the Koreans have a bid, the Chinese have a bid in. So the Saudis are right now, you know, looking at all the proposals. I don't really think the Chinese one will have a shot at it. It came in late, right? The Chinese bid came in pretty late. I think realistically, they'll probably, my guess is, go for the Korean bid. But, you know, let's see whether, you know, it's all complicated with the 1-2-3 agreements with the U.S. because part of the Korean technology is, you know, licensed from the U.S., which means that the Saudis would have to be bound by a 1-2-3, that the U.S. Nuclear cooperation agreements that have a lot of restrictions. So we'll see whether the Saudis are actually willing to do that. But so far, you know, the Korean, they have the experience in the UAE, obviously. And they have a good domestic nuclear reactor program. So I think they have quite a lot of advantages. But, you know, who knows? Someone can pull a rabbit out of hat. And energy choices, especially nuclear, is always a political decision, as we saw in the UAE as well. It was tied to other things. So it won't be surprised if it's also a political decision that Saudi Arabia takes. And they could surprise everyone.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think that the Koreans have an advantage on this one for sure, just because it's politically so much easier. But yeah, time will tell. Mark, you've been talking with people in the region about Russia for years now. You've got a really interesting network of people around here that have been thinking about it. Just wondering, you know, like, we've seen Russia become a bigger actor again. You know, when the Soviet Union collapsed, and that was the idea. Russia's not a big deal here anymore, and then suddenly it became a big deal again. When you talk to people from the Middle East about this, what kind of, you know, how do they see Russia's reemergence into the region? Is this something that people are, you know, wary of, excited about? Is it, you know, what are people thinking about Russia as an actor here?
You know, I think that actually people in the Middle East are happy for Russia to play this role. I remember back in the 1990s that the Middle Easterners were really disappointed that the Russians had left. I remember going to a conference back when one could still do so in Sana'a in Yemen. I think it was 1992, and it was about essentially, you know, Yemen navigating the, you know, the collapse of the Soviet Union. And to me, what was shocking was just that the real emotional disappointment and anger that the Russians were no longer there to help the Yemenis, because after all, what else was their point in life? And that now I think that what we see is that that there is a degree of happiness. Certainly, what I think was interesting that during the Cold War, if you see Soviet influence increase in some countries, this made others nervous. To me, what was amazing about the Russian intervention in Syria beginning in 2015 was that other countries didn't seem to really feel threatened. In other words, you have a number of Russian armed forces coming in into the Middle East, and this was not seen as a threat to neighboring countries at all. And I think that partly, you know, this is because the preference, I think, in the Middle East is to have competing external great powers to navigate between. They didn't like the idea, at least the perception, of an American-dominated unipolar world order. I don't think the U.S. actually was particularly dominant, but that was certainly the impression that there was only one great power and that one had to respond to its demands, whether one liked it or not, and they often did not. Certainly the George W. Bush administration's calling for democratization in the greater Middle East. And so I think having Russia as an active competitor in the region is something that that they like. And I think that they're happy to have China as well. I think there's even those who would like to see India play such a role. That's what gives the local actors leverage. In other words, that especially, and even the United States. In other words, that if they're worried the United States is leaving, I don't think it actually is, but if this is what they're worried about, what they know is that the U.S. Feels threatened by Russia. Therefore, flirting with Russia is a great way to get America's attention, isn't it? And so I think that's, and they're not above doing this. And so I think that in general, in fact, I think the real fear, at least for a while, was that Russia might have actually been defeated in Ukraine, and then the older situation would reemerge, in which the U.S. was the predominant power, and China was not yet as interested to play as big a political military role as it is an economic role. So I think that this is partly why we see the diffidence in the Middle East with regard to the war in Ukraine. It's not that they really support Russia's activities in Ukraine, but they don't want to see Russia lose. And it's too bad about Ukraine, but they have their own interests to think about.
Mm. It's been interesting as great power competition, you know, drives a lot of U.S. foreign policy. The Indo-Pacific is a priority theater. You know, there's this idea, I think, for a lot of folks that the Middle East is, well, at least before October 7th, there was an idea that the Middle East is kind of less relevant to, you know, policy community and think tanks and, you know, unless...
You know, I've never quite understood this. I guess partly because I grew up during the Cold War. The Soviet-American competition was a worldwide competition. It was a competition in each and every region of the world. So that if there is going to be this... overarching Chinese-American competition, it will also be a competition in each and every region of the world. Certainly China is active in the Middle East, it's active in Africa, it's active in Latin America. And so, you know, I would have thought that the you know, the governments in the region would recognize this as something, oh yes, this is something like very similar to what we had during the Cold War, because it seems to me that if anything, a Chinese-American competition will guarantee that the U.S. is interested in the Middle East, just as the Russian-American competition has done so. So, yeah, I don't see American interest in this region declining.
No, I agree. But I was just going to say that a lot of the times when people say the Middle East is, we're not focusing on Middle East projects the way we used to. But if you can say we've got a China-Russia project, you know, China-Russia are in the Middle East, and then people get interested in a hurry. So, yeah, I think it's business is good for the stuff the three of us work on.
Can I just jump in here and just say that, Mark, I completely agree with your the Gulf states don't want to see Russia losing, you know, in the Russia-Ukraine war, but also China doesn't want Russia to lose, right? It is not in China's interest to see Russia losing, partly because of the force multiplier effect that we talked about. If you have one partner less or less powerful, then, you know, by extension, then China becomes, you know, its influence dwindles a little bit because you don't have that augmented influence. So it's not just the Gulf states, but China as well. And it's not just, I suppose, China, you know, the Gulf states flirting with Russia, they're also flirting with China, to use your analogy, in order to get the U.S. to be interested.
Right, yeah. I guess there's a little more than flirting, but we needn't go into that analogy.
Yeah, well, I think there's been a couple of points where Beijing's been, I wouldn't say lucky, that's a little too cynical, but you think of, you know, when George W. Bush was running for president and it was all about China, and the September 11th happened, and I think a lot of folks took their eye off the ball, of course, and focused on the Middle East. And then, you know, when the Indo-Pacific starting to become actualized, and then the war in Ukraine starts and everybody kind of refocuses again. So, you know, it's given China a little bit of breathing space. And I think, I agree, Li Chen, I think for Beijing, the idea of Russia losing would be a nightmare situation. Li Chen, I want to ask you, you've been in the Gulf for quite a while. How do you think folks here, you know, whether it's mostly, I guess, in the policy community, people in different governments, how should they be thinking about, you know, greater Russian and Chinese involvement in the Middle East, in the Gulf?
Well, I think I've got two points to make here. So one, I think that they should sometimes see the declarations that China and Russia make, or some of the engagements that they make with the Gulf states or with the Middle Eastern states, as a kind of signaling. It plays a signaling game. I don't think it really has, you know, too much substance in it, but it's there to signal something or to, you know, to gain American attention, as Mark mentioned. So one example is the drones, right? The Americans didn't want to sell their, you know, their Reaper high altitude drones to the Gulf states for many years. And so the Gulf states went to China to buy, you know, different kinds of drones, Saudis went to China, and so did the UAE. And they've got their drones, but they still want the really high-tech Reaper drones because it's high altitude. You can see more things. It's more for surveillance, you know, harder to shoot down, that kind of thing. But, you know, Qatar did get U.S. drones, but these were, you know, not at the level of the Reaper drones, they were others. And the UAE is still negotiating for the drones. But again, I think that sometimes when you buy these weapons from other countries, it kind of tells your target, right, your main target, hey, look, I have options. Even if you don't sell me your, like, super sophisticated drones, I have options. So maybe you should think about selling me your drones, because if not, I'll go to others, right? So I think sometimes some of these things are signaling functions, just like the S-400, which the Saudis were said to be interested in purchasing from the U.S., the S-400 from the Russians, but apparently now they're not going to do it now that they're negotiating, you know, maybe a closer relationship with the U.S., with, you know, certain security guarantees, etc. This now seems to be off the table. So this is the signaling function I mentioned, that sometimes the policy community here, especially from the U.S., tends to jump when they see some of these interactions, right? I guess they're a bit worried, but I think they should sometimes take these with a with a grain of salt, or a huge grain of salt. The second point I wanted to make was that I think the US, if it wants to counter some of these moves, should think about not going it alone. Sometimes the US tends to want to just go it alone and say, okay, to counter the US or to counter China or Russia, we're going to do this. But I think they have to sort of think in terms of cooperating with their allies, right? They have strong allies in the Japanese and in the Koreans, for example. These two have very, very good relations with the Gulf states. So I think the US should actually use, you know, their good relations with China and with Japan and Korea to actually counter, you know, some of these Chinese moves, because the Chinese themselves are actually cooperating sometimes with the Japanese and the Koreans. One good example is in the Saudi refinery in Rabi itself. It was built by the Chinese, but the financing part of it was from the Japanese. And so, you know, despite competition between the East Asian states, they do cooperate in areas in the energy sector, not just in petrochemicals, but in renewables, where you do see the Japanese financing Chinese-built projects in the Gulf, right? So I think that the U.S. could take a leaf from that and also cooperate, you know, with the Japanese or with the Koreans in the Middle East. You know, it's not just them who have to go it alone, the U.S. So I'd like actually to see more of these cooperation.
Yeah, yeah. Here. I talk about this one all the time. You know, there was that meeting in Washington earlier this fall with leaders from Japan, Korea, and the U.S. Working on more strategic affairs across the Indo-Pacific. And I think this is a region where all three have really deep and important interests. You've seen the Japanese Prime Minister Kishida was here in the summer. Foreign Minister was here, I believe, in September. You know, there's a lot of big stuff happening. It's been interesting because Japan, I think, has typically been seen as more of a customer. And you could see from these visits where the Japanese leaders were saying, look, we can help you in your energy transition. We can help you on more strategic things. The Koreans have been selling weapons and made security commitments. So, yeah, it is a pretty interesting dynamic. Mark, how about from the view from the D.C. metro area? What would you say to folks in the Washington policy community who are thinking about Russia and China in the region?
You know, I think that one of the things that we simply have to accept is that there is going to be cooperation in the region with China and Russia. I think that, you know, it's not something we can stop, so we shouldn't try to. You know, I think that, you know, I would underline what Yunli Chen said about, you know, working with Japan and South Korea. Also, I think that one mustn't forget our European partners, not to mention our Canadian, Australian partners as well. There's lots of people whom we can work with. I do think that I personally feel that ultimately the U.S. and China, that doesn't need to be this Cold War style conflict between the two. I think that there can be room for negotiation and cooperation. I don't really see Chinese-American competition as necessarily being zero-sum. Unlike, I think, between Russia and the United States. In other words, that I think that, you know, in general, you know, China is looking to work with governments. Now, of course, Russia is too in the region, but I think that, you know, this war in Ukraine, to the extent that it interrupted, you know, food supplies and could do so again, that this has the capacity for really undermining numerous countries in the Middle East, often, you know, poorer ones, but, you know, instability in those poorer countries is going to affect the richer ones as well. So, you know, it seems to me that the U.S. and China and, you know, most of the governments in the Middle East have an interest in stability, something that Russia really doesn't. That Russia really does, it benefits from instability, or so that's how it sees its interests under Putin. And so I think that this is something that we ought to think of as well, that maybe China is a better alternative. In other words, if the Middle Eastern countries are going to cooperate with anyone, maybe we're better off if they cooperate more with China and less with Russia. Now, some might think that that's a naive point of view, but I think that at the moment, I think that that's something that we should be open to. And I think that ultimately that you know, Russia that it's going to, I think, is entering a crisis, it seems to me. In other words, that I think that, you know, even it's not clear to me that they can win this war, that Putin's going to pursue it no matter what, but that even if they somehow prevail, if they overrun Ukraine, it's going to be Russia at odds with the West, so long as that's the case. And I think that, you know, Middle Eastern countries are going to have a harder time. I think, in other words, if Middle Eastern countries are worried about, you know, are the Americans going to protect us sufficiently? Well, then the real question is, well, who else is? In other words, will Russia be able to do so? I'm not so sure. Is China willing to do so? I'm not so sure. So I think that we have to work with our Middle Eastern partners to understand that they have different interests than we do, but to focus on what our common interests are, because that's simply too important for this cooperation to cease, it seems to me.
That's all great, but I think the headline from this is going to be Professor Katz calls for a Sino-Soviet split in the Middle East. Look, guys, I'm so glad you were able to do this. I've been wanting to have the two of you on. You've been on my wish list for a long time. I've been wanting to do this show for months now. I'm glad we're able to do this. Thanks for doing it so close to the holidays. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having us. And it was great seeing, talking with both of you again.
Yeah,
and I'm glad we made your Christmas wish come true.
Thanks. Okay, well, and to the audience, thanks for joining us again. We'll have another episode coming out hopefully in a couple of weeks. Pretty good one lined up. So you know what to do, like, listen, subscribe, and all that stuff. And we'll see you all soon. Thank you.